Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, June 6, 2010, and this is show number 263. Well, that sounded a little bit like I was in a really big shoe, but it is a big show because this week I was at All Things Digital, the conference hosted by the Wall Street Journal and technology columnists Walter Mossberg and Kara Swisher. This was the 8th conference, they also call it D8, and it was my 5th time or possibly 6th time attending it, I can't remember. If you haven't heard me talk about it before, it's a 3-day conference where Walt and Kara sit on stage with the CEOs of the top tech and media companies in the world. The attendee list is equally impressive. The opportunity to have one-on-one conversations with huge people in the industry, just sitting, having lunch, or over a drink, is one of the biggest benefits of the conference. I'll try to give you what I felt were the high points of each of the sessions without gushing too much. Opening night was Steve Jobs, CEO of Apple Computer. You know I'm an Apple fanboy, so after he spoke, I asked many people, was he really as great as I thought I was that night? Or was it really just the reality distortion field that we know so much about? Every person I asked said, no, he was really amazing that night. Martha Stewart, believe it or not, is a technologist, and she told me she thought his answers were all very thoughtful and honest and showed the great leadership of the man. All right, good enough for me. I needed that checkpoint, though. A major topic of discussion was the flash issue and Jobs' open letter about it. Walt said that even if all of what Steve said about flash was true, is it really the best thing for consumers to be, you know, so abrupt and cut us all off? Steve explained that Apple doesn't have a lot of resources. They're awfully big to not have a lot of resources. But anyway, he said they have to choose what to chase. And if you choose wisely, you can do great. He walked through several of the technologies that Apple has abruptly cut off. He pointed out that they got rid of the 5-inch floppy and switched to 3.5-inch. Then later, they got rid of the 3.5-inch floppy long before anybody else. They got rid of serial and parallel ports. They even got rid of the optical drive with the MacBook Air. He pointed out that people call them crazy. But how did all that turn out? Well, I remember when the 3.5-inch floppy was removed and we all raced out and bought external floppy drives and never used them once. He pointed out that there are some holes in the internet now if you'd use an iPhone or an iPad, but he also pointed out that those holes are getting filled pretty rapidly. I personally have experienced that. I'm seeing fewer and fewer places where I can't get the content that I want. Walt asked whether this move is fair to developers, and Steve brought up the fact that they axed HyperCard, and it was even bigger than Flash. Has anyone researched that claim to see if that's true? Hard to believe there were that many HyperCard developers, but there's people still developing for HyperCard right now. Steve explained that they told Adobe that they would use Flash if it ran well, and it wasn't until the iPad came out that Adobe started making a big stink about it not supporting Flash, even though the iPhone didn't either. And heck, let's be honest, the Android operating system doesn't have it yet either. Adobe put up that big stink in the press, and Apple just got tired of it. He said that's why they had to publish the letter explaining their point of view. Walt expressed concern about sites like Picnic, which is a great site that allows you to edit photos online. Steve said that we have courage and focus on technologies that are in their ascendancy. At this point, he said perhaps the most telling statement. He said, if we succeed at making great products, you buy them. If we don't, you don't buy them. It was such a simple statement, but it really rang true, especially when we pointed out that they've been selling one iPad every 3 seconds, and they just wish they could build them faster than one every 3 seconds. When questioned about the stolen iPhone and the whole Gizmodo issue, Steve said a few things I found interesting. He said that they don't know if their employee actually lost it or if it was stolen from his bag. That might explain why the guy still has his job, giving him the benefit of the doubt on that. He also explained how the police got involved, and I had not heard this before. He said that the reporter plugged in the stolen iPhone into his roommate's computer to try and activate it. When she realized what was going on, she was the one who called the police to make sure she wasn't implicated. Steve described the entire scenario as sounding like a movie with intrigue and theft and betrayal. He said he was pretty sure there was sex involved in there somewhere, too, and somebody ought to make a movie out of it. He said that a lot of people advised him to let the whole Gizmodo issue blow over, to let it slide. He did some real soul searching on that, but said that in the end, he realized that just because they're becoming big and influential doesn't mean they should abandon their core values, and so it was wrong to let it slide. I know Steve is a practiced speaker, but this was one of those points where it really looked like his statements came from the heart. One of the classic things people say about Apple is if Steve denies a product is in the works, you can pretty much put money on them doing it. He said no one would ever want to watch video on a small screen. He said that they'd never have an app store. And on Tuesday night, when asked why they acquired the search company Siri, he said, "They're not a search company. They're an artificial intelligence." And that Apple has no plans to go into the search business. Does this mean we can bank on Apple going into the search business now? Walt asked Steve whether the iPad is the hope of journalism. Steve said that they have a lot of goals with the tablet and that any democracy depends on a free, democratic press with editorial and news gathering. He doesn't want to see us descend into a nation of bloggers. Anyway, Apple can help with that, and he's happy. He pointed out that all of our news has moved to the web and that we have to figure out how to get real reporters paid for this hard-earned content. He said that as one of the largest sellers of content on the web, Apple priced the content aggressively and makes their money in volume. He's trying to get these content companies to be more aggressive as they don't have any printing costs and make their money in volume. Well, I have several comments to add in here. One of my pet peeves is bloggers and podcasters who call themselves journalists. To me, a journalist is someone who researches, calls the sources directly, flies to Afghanistan and experiences what's happening firsthand, or at least talks directly to warfighters to understand. Today, people read what journalists wrote or watch videos of someone else's work, and then they write or talk about it and call themselves journalists. Leo Laporte, who I listen to constantly, makes this mistake himself. He's repeatedly called himself a journalist, but today he's on the air so much, it's very rare that he ever gets to hear anything firsthand himself. He has opinions and analysis, and I frequently find his opinions very valuable and insightful, but he doesn't have firsthand knowledge in a lot of cases where he pontificates. I'm not sure I'd call myself a journalist, but if you read or listen to me carefully, you'll notice that it's rare I'm quoting someone else's experience. When I review something, it's because I have personally touched it and worked with it. Again, I still don't think I'm a journalist, but you get my point. The second comment I'd like to make is that Steve is spot on about the media companies lowering prices to compensate for the lack of printing. I believe I did a long rant about this with ebooks, how they should chop off the cost of printing, binding, boxing, shipping, and sitting on store shelves, take that same dollar profit, but increase their percentage profit enormously by dropping the cost of the book to erase all those costs they no longer have. Okay, back to Steve. Steve used an analogy to explain where he sees traditional PCs going. He said that when we were an agrarian nation, all cars were trucks. When we moved into the urban environment, we started to change the cars into sedans. PCs are going to be the trucks of the new era. We still need trucks, but the car is changing. Walt made sure that when Steve said PCs, he included Macs as the definition of personal computers. Steve said he does include all laptops and desktops regardless of operating system. He said it'll make people from the PC world, like himself and Walt, very uncomfortable. Vested intents are going to change in the next 1, 3, maybe 7 years, though. Steve spoke about his term magical for the iPad. He said people laugh at him for it, but he said there is something magical about it. He said you have a much more intimate relationship with it than other devices. Some intermediate thing has been removed, as though you're in that Claritin commercial when the film is removed. He asked if it's the cables being removed. Is it the touch? Is it the 10-hour battery life? I caught myself trying to explain this the other day, and I said, not intending to put a pun on it, but I said, I can't put my finger on it. What is it? Maybe that is the magical part. Walt brought up that many people say the iPad is not a content creation device, and Steve said that, you know, if I want to write a 35-page analyst report, you know, you'd want to use a Bluetooth keyboard, but that's only 1% of the time he's using it. He said that the software will get better. He can actually see us editing video and doing all kinds of things on it in the future. I enjoyed this conversation myself because I wrote 11 pages of notes during using the iPad at D8 using just the on-screen keyboard. Next week, I'm going to go into a lot of detail of how that worked for me and what I thought of using the iPad as a content creation device. But there's no time this week. We have way too much to say. Walt pushed Steve to talk about the black box operation of the App Store. While any merchant has the right to not carry anything they don't want to carry, is there a downside to him acquiring all of this power? Steve explained, he answered it by explaining that there's HTML5, CSS, and JavaScript that are all open and that Apple has the best support of this completely open platform of the web. In addition, they also operate a controlled, curated platform. They insist on public APIs for stability, and he gave an interesting statistic. He said they approve 95% of applications submitted within 7 days. He talked about the mistake where a political satirist cartoons got caught up in the App Store rule that you're not allowed to defame anyone. He gave some insight here that I hadn't heard before. He said the guy submitted the application, it got rejected. They figured out the mistake and they fixed the algorithm. Later, the guy was queried by the press, and when he said it had been rejected, they jumped on it and made a huge deal out of it. But that the satirist himself was very professional and hadn't raised a big stink. He just hadn't resubmitted after they'd fixed it. Steve was humble at this point, and he said, Apple is guilty of making mistakes. That, you know, no one has ever done this before, and that they're learning as fast as they can and fixing things as fast as they can. I have trouble finding fault with him here, but I know others, like maybe Bart, will still disagree with this approach. Another close encounter with how Steve thinks came when Walt asked him what he does all day. He just said, you know, so what do you do? Steve said he has the best job in the world. He gets to hang out with the smartest, best people making cool stuff. Apple is an incredibly collaborative company that has zero committees. One person is in charge of each thing, just like a startup. They all meet for 3 hours once a week and talk about everything they're doing, and he says you have to trust everyone to do their part. Walt asked him whether people ever tell him he's wrong. He swore that they do. He said that they have wonderful arguments, and the only way you can have great people working for you is to have the best ideas be able to win. I hope this is true, but it does sound kind of hard to believe from the picture we all have in our heads of what it's like to work for him. I worked for a vice president once who said such a great quote. I love to quote this guy. He said, I refuse to be surrounded by yes men, because if that were the case, the best idea we'd have would be mine, and we can do better than that. I really took that statement to heart. Well, the high point for me was when they opened up the microphone for questions to Steve. As you may recall, I've been practicing a question for like 3 weeks in hopes of this very moment. Well, I got to ask my question, and it turned out to have a much more important effect than I thought. Asking a question at D is tricky because you have to be crisp about it, or Walt gets agitated and gives you the hurry-up signal. Because sometimes people do have a tendency to ramble or talk about themselves or never actually get a question out. Here's what I asked. I bought the movie Up on Blu-ray with digital download for my portable devices. I bought the VGA adapter. But because of copyright protection, I cannot play Up on my projector. If I'd stolen Up by BitTorrenting or reversing the copy protection, I would have been able to play it. Can you please explain to me how HDCP helps in the fight against piracy? Steve listened carefully and said that movie companies are worried they'll go through the Napster situation. He said they aren't in the security business, so they're grabbing at straws. Sometimes they grab the right straw, and sometimes they grab the wrong one. He said that Apple pressures them as much as they can, but if they insist, Apple only has two choices. And then he said, I feel your pain. Steve feels my pain. Anyway, I asked him if he'd please point out the irony of the straw they've chosen. The crowd reaction was great. They not only applauded the question, every person I talked to for the rest of the week said, hey, you asked a great question. It was so fun to be rewarded for how much I practiced on that one. A lovely gentleman named Lee Stein spoke to me at length about my question and how articulate I was. I was preening like a peacock during that. There'll pretty much be no living with me now, especially since Martha Stewart told me I'd asked a great question. One person even told me that my question was on par with Martha's hilarious questions to Sir Howard Stringer of Sony about why they make us buy so many different chargers for our devices. Now that's high praise. That same day, I got a chance to hang out with Stuart Alsup, technology columnist, a guy I used to love to read in Fortune magazine. I kidded around with him about how he's my Facebook friend, because last year he told me that he asked all beautiful women to be his Facebook friends, and so we are friends on Facebook. He made a point of also telling me how great my question was. Now, I'm only telling you that little part about Stuart because that story comes up again later. Now, don't worry. I won't spend as much time on all the other speakers as I did on Steve. In fact, I'm going to skip over a lot of them and only talk to things I thought were really interesting. One thing that was interesting is that just about every CEO mentioned the iPad and how they're using it. In the room, probably 60% of the people were using iPads, and it started to look odd when you see someone with this giant laptop. When Julius Genachowski, the Federal Communications Commission chairman, was on stage, Walt asked him if the president of the United States had one, and he said if he doesn't, he's pretty sure someone's working on it for him. While we're taking a breather, let's chat a little bit about ScreenSteps, shall we? If you've been sitting on the fence about buying ScreenSteps, it might help you to see it in action. Over at ScreenSteps.com, they have some great articles on how to improve your software documentation to benefit your customers. I put a link in the show notes to the articles, and if you're more of the please spoon feed me type like I am, there's webinars there on how to use the right tool at the right time, when to use video, when to use screencasts, and when to use still images. Even if you don't buy ScreenSteps, I'm betting that you'll learn something about how to help your customers if you check that out. Assuming that you're smarter than that, though, and you do buy ScreenSteps Desktop, don't forget the coupon code NOCILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, to get 25% off the purchase price. Speaking of tablets, Walt and Kara invited the folks from, I think it's pronounced no.com, it's KNO.com, to demonstrate their new tablet concept. It was pretty clear to me that the hosts were trying to find anyone with anything interesting in the tablet market other than the iPad to try and have a more balanced view of all things iPad and tablets. But with HP out of the game until they figure out how to adapt webOS to the tablet, and with Microsoft completely out of the game for now, they had to dig deep. They were super polite to these guys, but I had a lot of problems with the No device. The No is aimed straight at the student market to replace everything that's in today's backpacks, from books to notebooks to pens to sticky notes. Unfortunately, they sort of had to misrepresent a lot of facts to make their comparison go well. They said that a typical student backpack is around 20 pounds. I weighed my kids' backpacks. They were closer to 40, but they were overachievers, so perhaps that accounts for the difference. They also said the typical student laptop is 15 to 17 inches and weighs 7 pounds. No, that's not right. I'd put it closer to 13 to 15 inch and no more than 5 pounds. But that wouldn't really help their story. So let's talk about what the No is. It's two 14-inch screens connected together by a flexible seatbelt fabric hinge that allows them to flip so they can close completely facing each other or flip all the way around to have them facing apart. The No weighs 5.5 pounds, which is surprisingly light for how huge this device is. They didn't say how thick it was, but I'd estimate that each screen was about 3/4 inch thick, so it's pretty bulky. Enough about dimensions. The No is designed to have a beautiful displays. The guy said it so many times Walt started teasing him about it. And then, of course, they had to say, well, you know, Steve's allowed to say his device is magical. They can call it beautiful. Anyway, the idea is these beautiful displays show off rich textbooks with graphics. It's going to have Wi-Fi, but no 3G, because they said most campuses are covered with Wi-Fi, which seems to be true, but not always good Wi-Fi, at least at UCLA. It will support Office formats, PDFs. It'll have a virtual keyboard and support Bluetooth keyboards as well. The operating system is Linux with WebKit. That's the browser technology under Safari and Chrome, and will support Flash. They quoted 6 to 8 hours of battery life with a price tag of under $1,000. I really like these guys, but this thing is way too freaking big. It's got to be impossible to hold with no support holding those two giant displays at an angle to each other. Because remember, it's a flexible hinge. It's a seatbelt, literally seatbelt, and it just kind of flops around. It doesn't have any kind of friction to it. This thing is way too heavy, and it's way too expensive. They did say they have deals with 4 education book companies, which represents about 75% of all book companies, but I still can't imagine this being a device a student would want. You can take a look at it yourself over at no.com. Again, that's KNO.com. FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski was pretty interesting, but Walt was brutal with him. It's interesting to watch who Walt is gentle with and who he gives more respect. Basically, Walt asked him why hasn't he fixed everything yet. He pointed out that Jenikowski isn't from the telcos, but still, we're lagging the world in broadband. Jenikowski pointed out that out of 40 countries, we were determined to be 6th out of 40 in broadband speeds, but that wasn't what concerned him. What really scared him was the finding that we're 40th out of 40 in the rate of change of innovation. He didn't explain how that was measured, but he called that the canary in the coal mine, and I think I'd have to agree with that. Again, Walt attacked with the, why don't you fix this? Isn't this your job? Jenikowski said they spent the last year making the plan to fix this, to drive more competition, giving us more options. He said that we have to take advantage of mobile, so that's why we're the first country going to 4G. I don't know if that's true, but he said so. The demand on the networks isn't going down. It's going up at a rate that dwarfs the rate of increase of the status quo plan, so the status quo plan just isn't going to get us where we need to go. He said to expect network congestion for a long time and that we have to find better efficiencies. I sure would have liked to hear some details of the plan and maybe a timetable of implementation of the plan, but he didn't touch on any of those icky little details. Walt kept pushing and tried to get Jenikowski to discuss consequences from the FCC when a provider doesn't deliver what the user is paying for, like making phone calls on their iPhone. Instead of even addressing the question, Jenikowski started talking about how confused customers are about what speeds they're getting or should expect on broadband. Oh well, I sure hope that plan he's got is good and implementable in our lifetimes. One of my favorite speakers was the CEO of Qualcomm, Paul Jacobs. I liked him because he's an engineer and a total geek, and that threw Kara for a loop. Seriously, it's not that she's not technical, it's that he came right out spouting specs and acronyms right and left. Luckily, she did slow him down because he said one thing that really confused me, and she made him back up and explain it. He was talking about how Qualcomm's technology is in every smartphone out there. Kara said, well, wait a minute, you make CDMA phones, and the iPhone is a GSM phone, so how are you in that? Jacobs explained that GSM phones still use CDMA for their 3G data. I did not know that. The most important thing Jacobs talked about was a new display technology they're working on, trademarked called Mirasol. That's M-I-R-A-S-O-L if you want to go look it up. The trick of this technology is that it's reflective the way a butterfly's wings are reflective. So when you reflect light off of it, specific wavelengths interfere with each other to create color. The underlying technology is dependent on the use of MEMS mirrors. MEMS stands for micro-electromechanical systems. The MEMS in Mirasol are actually tiny mirrors going up and down inside each pixel, and as they change distance from each other, they create a different color. Okay, but what does all that mean to us? It means lower power consumption, also known as longer battery life. He said it was 10 to 100 times more efficient than an LCD, depending on the lighting conditions. It also gives you brighter displays in broad daylight, so they can light it up indoors for you with low power, and it still looks fantastic outside, even better outside. And it's color. Kind of sounds like the best of both worlds between e-ink and the LED LCD displays. The even better news is that they already have a fab shop making these, and they expect to have up to 5.7-inch displays as early as next year. They'll be starting with e-readers, but there's no reason they can't be in touchscreen displays as well, with a sheet of glass on top of it. I'm excited about this because it's really smart people working on the number one problem we have, battery life. Qualcomm had a booth in the science fair, and Dan Baker was there showing off the new Dell Streak at their booth. Qualcomm was displaying the Streak, along with other devices, because it sports their Snapdragon processor. I made a quick video of the Streak during my interview, and I've embedded it in the show notes. The Streak is an Android smartphone, but its distinction is that it has a massive 5-inch display. There are those who have suggested that this is too big to be a smartphone and too small to be a tablet and is therefore useless. I hate it when people do that who haven't actually touched the device. You may decide that after you touch it, but, you know, touch it first. The screen is huge on this device, but somehow it doesn't feel huge because it's very thin and it's nicely rounded on the edges. As I say in the video that you'll be able to go look at, it's very holdable. It feels good. The screen was very responsive and bright. In the 2 minutes I got to play with it, I couldn't say it was necessarily something I would buy, but it's definitely worth taking a look at. The Qualcomm Snapdragon process is worth consideration too. Processor, I should say, is worth consideration. They have a 1.5 gigahertz version coming out soon. And they also just announced a dual core 1.2 gigahertz processor for phones. And now it's time for the train wreck that was Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook. I was shocked that he would agree to come to Dee with all of the hubbub about privacy settings in Facebook, but at least he did have the courage to be there. It's about the only good thing I can say about the interview. Walt dug right in at the beginning, asking him why he thought it was okay to change our privacy settings on us. Mark said that there are misperceptions and that people need to be able to find you. They need some information to figure out if you're the one they're looking for. People with common names, how are they going to figure out if you're you? People have the misconception that we tried to make everything public. Sensitive things like your contact info and photos are not made public. Excuse me? He is either A, a liar, or B, completely out of touch with what his company is doing. I'm pretty sure he's not an idiot. Last week, before the new and improved privacy settings were put up, I checked, and 100% of my photos are now set to everyone is having access. I have never, ever, 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 ever chosen that as an option. I didn't even allow friends of friends, much less everyone. I believe he's too technically smart not to know what his algorithm did, so I must presume that he's simply lying at this point. When Zuckerberg said that they changed some things and always asked people to review them, Walt asked, why do I have to go to the work of fixing what you're changing? Zuckerberg's only answer was, simple control has always been a part of Facebook. Okay, now I have to back off the liar statement and move to delusional. Walt moved in for the third time, asking why Zuckerberg thought he had the right to make our information public. But before he could do another non-answer, Kara broke in and started asking him questions about his personal life. At this point in time, I couldn't imagine why she did this, but it actually became apparent later. At this point, Zuckerberg started to fall apart. He started to babble. He was talking and saying sentences that had nothing to do with the conversation. And then he started to sweat. Now, I don't mean a light beating on the forehead. I mean rivulets of sweat pouring down the side of his face. Even though it was actually uncomfortably cold in the audience, I know the lights can get extremely hot, but you couldn't watch this complete mental and physical breakdown without thinking of Nixon in the 1960 presidential debate against Kennedy. Around this time, Kara and Walt started to treat him gently like a young child that needed to be taken care of. Kara suggested that he take off his hoodie, which just sounds wrong that a CEO of a squillion-dollar company would be wearing a hoodie to arguably one of the most important interviews of his life, but he said, I never take off my signature hoodie. The man is literally melting on stage and he thinks this look is important. Finally, he acquiesces and Kara actually has to help him with his jacket. Then when she pulled his jacket off, he mentioned that the company vision is actually printed on the inside of the jacket. It was kind of scary, actually. Someone tweeted the perfect description of it. It looked like the Dharma Initiative logo. Okay, Mark has wiped the buckets of sweat off his face. He's had a moment of fun with his hoodie. So Walt asks him a fourth time whether sharing information shouldn't be opt-in. He doesn't think so. He said it'd be crazy to make people opt into everything. Like when they created the news feed in Facebook, it wouldn't make sense to make people opt in. Even though he also said a lot of people asked him if he would have done that, wouldn't that have been better to do to people? He assured us that as you begin to use these applications, you'll have a good experience and you'll start to feel good about them. Sorry, Mark, I'm not having a good feeling about you sharing my personal photos with the internet. I would have put them on Flickr if I wanted them shared with the world. So I was talking to a producer during a break the next day. I really wish I could remember her name. And we were talking about the disastrous Zuckerberg interview, and I mentioned that I was kind of surprised that Kara and Walt didn't go in for the kill when Zuckerberg started to fall apart. I thought it was an obvious move to rip him to shreds at that point. She said, though, that if they had done that, they'd have looked like bad guys. Instead, by treating him like the poor child that he is, so very far out of his league, helping him with his jacket and being so gentle with him, they looked like nice people and his incompetence was magnified. I have to say, if I wasn't worried about my privacy on Facebook before, I'm terrified now. So, everyone, where are we going next? I'm ready to go, but I want to go where everyone else goes, so let's go. Where are we going? One last thought on privacy before we move on. Someone at one of the breaks explained that the lack of interest, that a lot of people have a lack of interest in privacy. They don't seem concerned about it. A lot of the young kids, they don't seem to think this is a big deal. He said it was like trying to connect smoking and cancer. The problem is so far away from the event that it's actually hard to picture what could possibly go wrong. I thought that was a pretty good analogy. Well, let's cleanse our palates now with a great interview. Steve Jobs was still probably my favorite of the show, but a very close second was the interview with James Cameron, writer, director, producer, most recently known for his films Avatar and Titanic. He was positively riveting. Walt asked a lot of questions about 3D. How necessary is it to the movie Avatar, for example? James said that 90% of his job was not about the 3D-ness, it was the actors, the colors, the plants. 3D does have fundamentally changed the storytelling. He noted that the 2D version of the DVD sold very well, and they weren't really sure that was going to happen, so it showed that storytelling is what's really important. He said the movie scales from iPhone to IMAX. He also said they're going to re-release it in the fall in 3D yet again. Walt asked, what movies wouldn't you make in 3D? And James said something like Schindler's List, made in black and white on purpose. 3D would ruin that film. On the other hand, he announced that they're remastering Titanic in 3D for the 100th anniversary of the event in 2012. That movie was frightening enough for me, though. I hate sunken or sinking ships. It just gives me the willies. Too much time sailing, I guess. Can you imagine as the ship turns vertical and the people are falling? How awful that would be in 3D. Well, at this point in the interview, it took a tangent to something very important. The work James Cameron is doing to try and assist with the British Petroleum oil leak. As he was watching the growing horror in the Gulf, he realized that he knows a lot of brilliant people in deep submergence who understand the engineering required at deeper depths. He approached BP first, and he said they were very gracious, but they said, we've got it. So he pulled 23 people together at the EPA headquarters to discuss solutions. They were given the facilities and the video teleconferencing so they could pull in experts from around the world to work the issue. They weren't officially sanctioned by any of the government entities. They were just allowed to work there. He talked about how the effective pressures they're working under are equivalent to 18,000 feet of pressure and that steel bends like butter under that pressure. He said, this is not a plumbing problem. And he noted that if they make any mistakes, they could blow this thing out and have it blow in 30 places at once, becoming even more catastrophic than it already is. He felt it was very important that the government get this independent source, these people that he brought together, or else it's like asking the criminal to provide the crime scene tapes. I could have listened to James talk about this for hours, but they wound up that part of the discussion with the fact that James' team is submitting a paper to all of the government agencies. He didn't give us any details on the recommendations, though. Walt asked James then about making his films available to people who want to watch on the small screen and yet not steal it. This is the only time when I thought James was off base. He said that if you take away the 2% of the population who have qualms about stealing and are under 30, you're left with 98% who will still steal. I don't think I agree with him here, and I think there's evidence that when iTunes came along and made it easy and convenient to pay for music at a reasonable price, people rushed to it in droves. I'm not saying people don't still steal, but I'm saying an awful lot of people switched to paying for music. One part I did like was when he was talking about how certain movies are better for certain formats. He said, I'd never watch 2001 on a laptop screen, but Hangover is just as funny on a laptop as it is on a big screen. Hangover's hilarious. I keep meaning to buy that one for future rewatching. What a great, funny film. Ridiculous, but funny. He also said he wouldn't watch a movie on an iPhone, but he would watch on an iPad. Then he said one of my favorite quotes. He said, I guess if it's too small, you're too old. True dat, Mr. Cameron. When it came time for Q&A, I again rushed to the microphone, and I did get to ask him a question. I told him that my dad always said there are no dumb questions, but that I was pretty sure my question was really dumb. I asked him to explain how his film was 3D, but it was computer graphics or CG. Which was it? Was it filmed or was it computer graphics? He was very gracious and didn't tell me I was dumb at all. Still not sure I completely understand the answer, but he said the movie was about 65% CG, but even that was shot with a virtual camera that he actually carried around. And sometimes the actors wearing suits with the facial things on, you know, and the balls and all that stuff. I liked the last line he said. He said, yeah, that was that last 2.5 years of R&D was figuring out how to do that. I guess it makes sense that I don't understand if it took him 2.5 years to do it. Okay, remember the story I told you about Stuart Alsop and how we were Facebook friends? Well, right after my question, Stuart Alsop is up to the microphone next. He takes the mic. Okay, this is in front of 500, 600, 700 people, something like that. We got Walter Mossberg on stage for crying out loud. And Stuart Alsop takes the mic and says, okay, Allison, you're like still my Facebook friend, but you just stole my question. I loved it. Walt and Kara had an interesting duo on stage with Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer and chief software architect Ray Ozzie. Ballmer was very bullish on the market due to Windows 7 and noted that even the business market is finally beginning to spend. Walt asked them to elaborate on their strategy for the cloud, and Ray Ozzie fielded that question. Not sure I understood his answer, though. He talked about standards-based ways to write application and that his mission is to get the developers in Microsoft to stop thinking about the PC as the objective and think about user productivity as the objective. That part made sense, but then he went on to say that this is the opportunity for us to re-pivot to the cloud for centralized work using different screens online and offline. Re-pivot. What does that mean? Did you already pivot once and you got to pivot again? What was the previous pivot? Anyway, Ballmer jumped in and said that you're still going to keep a lot of storage and processing on the client, and that the key is how you feed that to the server. Walt asked if that means that this is not the opportunity to create cheap, dumb devices. Ballmer explained that you will have cheaper devices, but you'll still need reasonable amounts of processing and graphics. At this point, Ray sort of contradicted Ballmer, saying that people just want appliances. They want to buy it, log in, and light it up, and that applications will feel more like caches. It was interesting to me that they sat side by side, contradicting each other. Maybe worry about how you have a consistent strategy when the top two most influential people have essentially the opposite opinions about where the technology is going. Walt asked them who their competition is. What threats do they see? Ballmer, of course, was the cheerleader, saying they're going from a world that was good for Microsoft to one that is great for Microsoft, but that they just have to out-hustle everyone else. In terms of competition, he listed Oracle, Apple, VMware, which I thought was interesting, and in television, both Nintendo and Sony. He actually also cited Firefox and Linux as primary competition, too. I think it's a good sign that they realize that. Walt brought up the fact that, unprompted by him and Kara, most of the speakers had a lot to say about the iPad. Ballmer admitted to actually using the iPad, which I thought was interesting because if he's smart, he'd be playing and working with it. He couldn't resist it, though. He had to make a smart aleck comment about it. You can't blame him. He said, I tried to use the on-screen keyboard. That was fun. Walt brought up Steve Jobs' assertion that fewer people will be using PCs as we go forward, PCs being Macs and Windows, and asked Ballmer what he sees in the future. Shockingly, Ballmer said people will be using PCs in more and more and greater numbers than ever before, but that they'll get smaller and have a keyboard or not, be media centers or touch UIs. He said the real question is, what's a PC? He said an iPad is a PC, so he sort of redefined the subject in his own terms. Walt brought up the fact that tablets haven't worked before. Will tablets of the future have Windows, look like Windows on his PC? Ballmer said that people want the familiar look of Windows. He said Linux tablets didn't sell well. And Walt said, well, that's because Microsoft lowered the price of XP to compete. And Ballmer simply repeated his statement and said, Linux netbooks didn't sell well. Ray Ozzie seemed to be much more in touch with consumer needs. He pointed out that more people consume than produce, so the pad form factor is better for that. He said that Microsoft has to drive out complexity and that virtualization technologies will let us move into the future. He said productivity and creativity is additive. You like to get the new features, but consumption is all about subtractive, removing complexity. I think he is spot on with this. Speaking of virtualization and pads, one of the folks I was sitting next to at the show demonstrated how he can securely connect over VPN into his company's network and use virtualization software to connect into a Blade server running Windows. I took a picture of it so you can see how weird seeing Microsoft Windows and Lotus Notes running on an Apple iPad using Cisco VPN software actually looks. Makes you think maybe we can all get along. Back on the competition angle and regarding mobile devices, Ballmer pointed out that RIM has 60 to 70% of their business in the consumer market, which people miss. Nokia is closer to zero in the U.S., but their international business shows a world-class supply chain. He said Apple has done the best job on the browser, and that's what has distinguished them amongst their competitors, and that they'll continue to be a good competitor. Wow, that's a change. Google has a lot of momentum in phones with Android, but he thinks on the larger screen, who knows, it's a jump ball. The one point where Ballmer seemed to get frustrated was when Walt asked him about the Chrome operating system from Google. I know he likes to jump around and act funny, and I've seen him do that where it's really appropriate and it works for him, you know, because he gets all agitated and excited. But he did it on this question, and it just kind of looked like flailing. When he was asked again about Chrome OS versus Android, he said that he doesn't understand it, and he started yelling. He yelled, "What am I supposed to think about it?" Then he started imitating that old commercial. He said, "It's two things, but not in one." Well, luckily, he brought along Ray Ozzie with him, who simplified it. He said that Android is a bet on the past as an operating system for phones, and that Chrome is the bet on the future. Chrome is all about devices working in the cloud. Ballmer insisted at the end that it still makes no sense to him. As a Honda and Acura owner, it pains me to say that I was really impressed with Alan Mulally, CEO of Ford Motor Company. He was so different from what you'd expect from an old auto company. He was dressed in a bright red sweater vest with a big Ford logo on it, and he spoke with candor, humor, and excitement about where Ford is going. The first thing that impressed me was when he said that he drove a Toyota Camry into work one day at the Ford corporate headquarters. He said they almost wouldn't let him in. Everyone thought he was crazy. He explained to them that there's no way to tell what their competition is doing unless they drive their cars. And he said right away, everyone else started testing out different cars too. That kind of shift in attitude has to be good for Ford and for the American auto industry. If Steve Ballmer can try out an iPad, Alan Mulally can drive a Camry. Alan described watching a woman driving a car with her hands through the steering wheel, holding a cell phone behind the wheel so she could text with both hands. He decided at that point that their objective should be that when you buy a Ford, you get the car with the newest tech that makes you a better driver. They put voice, music, and data all over Bluetooth, and they can make phones read text messages to you out loud. They can't do the reverse well enough yet, allowing you to text back using their voice, using your voice, but they're working on it. Their goal is to have instrumentation that's always right in front of you, so your hands are on the wheel and your eyes are on the road. Walt pointed out that on the lowest-end Ford car you can buy, a Ford Fiesta, the interface to his iPhone and iPod was better than anything on a Mercedes. Alan was obviously pleased with that and also pointed out that it used to cost you $400 for that setup, but it's now free on their cars for the first 3 years. Must be some sort of subscription service because I guess there's got to be some cost after that. I have to tell you, if I were in the market for a new car and I was not such a rabid Honda Acura fanatic, I would definitely consider a Ford after hearing Alan Mulally speak. Well, I'm going to wrap up the D8 coverage, and I know I skipped a lot of speakers, but these are the ones that intrigued and excited me the most. I want to give a shout-out to the two gentlemen who do the video and still photography for D, Robbie Lawrence and Asa Mathet. These two guys are scrambling all around the floor, up and down, off the stage, getting close-ups, panning the audience, and laying on the ground sometimes. I've never seen two people work so hard for 3 days straight in my life. Unless it's the guy that runs behind Robbie carrying his cable for his video camera, that guy's really busy trying to make sure Robbie doesn't fall over, get caught on something, and go flying. Anyway, I took a picture of Robbie and Asa, and I'm really proud of how it came out, so I had a picture of that in the show notes as well. And finally, I put a link into all the photos I took at D8 over at Flickr.com. So, you heard me talking about how great the Ford CEO was, but I really never could buy a Ford. While part of it is because I love Hondas and Acuras, the main reason is because of Honda Bob. I've only had one mechanic in my entire driving life, so how could I possibly go out and find a second one now at this stage in my life? I'm way too old to get a second mechanic. couldn't imagine going to the Dark Ages where you have to drive to them instead of them coming to you. How very barbaric. If you live in the LA or Orange County areas and you own a Honda or an Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. H.A. Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. It's time for my favorite time of the week. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchas from BartB.ie. How are you this fine Saturday, Bart?
I'm having a good time.
Yay!
Sorry, I just had to get another time into that sentence.
That wasn't enough, right? Well,
no, it's a holiday weekend here, and the sun is for now shining, so yay.
What holiday are you guys celebrating now? It's like Dog Catcher
Day. The wonderfully named June Bank Holiday.
It was the we don't feel like going to work today holiday?
I guess, or maybe because it's the middle of summer and that's worth celebrating.
I guess so. I guess, oh, it's today. No, it isn't the 21st yet.
No, we have the May Bank Holiday, which is May Day, which is basically like your Labor Day. Mm-hmm. And then we have the June Bank Holiday and the August Bank Holiday are the 2 one-day holidays to enjoy the summer.
That's so funny. It's just a holiday to not go to work.
Precisely. Well, I mean, we didn't have a convenient Independence Day right in the middle of summer, so.
Ah, I see. I see. You can't celebrate some nationality or left-handed people or something like that?
I guess we're not so big on making up excuses for the holidays. We just say, okay, great, no work, cheers.
Look it right in the eye, right?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, I'm pretty sure I will have recorded a giant long episode by the time people are hearing this, so we should probably kick in.
Okie dokie then. A quick security light. Next Tuesday is Patch Tuesday. The details are as usual sketchy for now, but what we can say is there are 3 critical patches, 7 important patches. They range from remote code execution to privilege escalation, which are a bad combination. And they affect Windows, Explorer, and Microsoft Office.
How lovely.
Yeah, so a good variety this month.
Sounds like fun. So wake up those Windows VMs.
Yes, exactly. On or after Wednesday, depending on your time zone. On or after Tuesday. So in Ireland, it's always Wednesday. And for you guys, it's Tuesday.
My head hurts.
Yeah, midweek. Anyway, the other one I thought I'd point out is there has been an update to OpenOffice. And they have gone to version 3.2. And they protect against a couple of flaws in their file processing bits and bobs, which would allow for remote code execution if you open the wrong GIF and so forth.
Oh, dear. I can't remember ever seeing an OpenOffice security patch, or at least that we ever talked about.
Yeah, that doesn't happen that often, but this one this one caught my attention, so I figured it would be worth telling people. We always go on about how you need to update your office. Well, you also need to keep your OpenOffice up to date.
So does that mean if you have NeoOffice or one of those two?
If you have NeoOffice, you're going to have to wait for the NeoOffice people to push out the updates. So I don't know if they're going to be available straight away.
Okay.
But actual OpenOffice, the update is available.
Okay.
And it now says Oracle instead of Sun.
Oh, it does.
Officially. Yeah, it just looks wrong. Like that red logo does not match any of the styling. But anyway.
You know, I wonder whether we're going to see a change. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but anybody who hosts their web servers on a Sun box, if they don't change their emoticon or their favicon themselves, It was the Sun logo. In fact, I pointed it out to Walter Mossberg of the Wall Street Journal. I said, so why are you advertising for Sun? And he's like, what the heck? That was fixed that day.
Yeah, no surprise. Yeah, I don't know if that's going to suddenly become a big red oracle everywhere.
Yeah, I wonder. All right, so that's it for Security Light. That's all we got?
That's it. Yeah, that's it for the light part. We have a medium, though.
Uh-oh.
Oh, this came up technically just before last week's show, but we had so much content that it went on for so long. I figured we'd wait a week and I'd see whether or not you decided to point me at it, and you did. So,
so it's my own darn fault that I allowed Security Medium in here?
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm pretty sure is there any way of talking about this and not saying no script at the end of the plot? So
it's not at the end. It's a solution, but not the solution.
Yay! All right, so start from the beginning for everyone.
Okay, so this started doing the rounds about a week ago, and it's been picked up on all sorts of places. It's a new technique for phishing with the PH.
Okay.
So it has nothing to do with catching bigger fish. It's another way of trying to trick you into handing over your sensitive data, like your username and password or your PIN number for your bank account website or something like that. It's another way of getting information out of you to the bad guy that you don't actually want to give to the bad guy. And it's actually, as always with these things, exceptionally clever. So on the one hand, you kind of have to admire their cleverness. And on the other hand, you have to fear their cleverness.
It's a double-edged thing. I can see that.
Yeah, so I admire it, but I don't like it.
Okay, got it.
So it's, again, a JavaScript-based attack. And the basic, it's called tab nabbing. And the basic idea is that they hijack an existing tab that you haven't used in a while, and so you've probably forgot is there, and they then rejig that tag to be a fake login screen for a service that you use.
So it's a tab you had open to something else?
It's a tab you have open to something else in which there is running some JavaScript.
Oh, okay.
That JavaScript, it could be hidden in an ad, it could be anywhere, right? It could be that the site has been hacked and the JavaScript's been injected.
Oh,
it could
okay.
be a dodgy ad has snuck in. It could be, you know, there's a million and one ways for JavaScript to get there. We've already seen this happen on the New York Times website where a dodgy ad was sending malicious JavaScript to every visitor.
Right, right.
So this stuff happens. Or you could simply go to a dodgy website and then have the JavaScript there anyway. But
you can ask for it directly.
Yeah, exactly. The point being, you have a tab open that contains this malicious JavaScript code. And what it does is it sits there and does absolutely positively nothing until the tab loses focus. So you leave the window or you move to another tab, whatever. The tab is no longer in front.
Okay.
At that point, it starts off a little timer and it waits for a certain amount of time until it's fairly sure that you've completely forgotten about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, using JavaScript, it changes the favicon in the menu bar, so that in the tab's little label, to the favicon of the site it's trying to imitate. And then it uses JavaScript to change the content of the page to look like the page you're trying to imitate the login screen. The theory being, you'll see the favicon, because that's how you recognize your tabs, especially when you have loads of tabs and the text is gone.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see the favicon, you'll click on it, and you'll see a login screen to, say, Gmail. Now, you won't remember that actually this particular tab had been useless thing number four. Because you're looking for Gmail now, so you're scanning through your tabs, you see the Gmail logo, you click on it, you see a login page, you say, oh, I've timed out, okay, fair enough, enter your details, and off they go to the bad guys.
Oh, wow.
Very clever. Yes. What makes it even more scary is that using a little trick, you know the way if you've been to a website before, the links are a different color?
Yes.
What you can do with JavaScript is generate a bunch of links, and then use CSS to read out what color those links are. And then based on the color, you know what sites the person that you whose browser you're in has visited. So you can then have a look through. Does this person use Gmail? No. Does this person bank with Bank of America? Yes. Aha.
So
Bank of America's favicon, Bank of America's login screen.
They're looking at things that I did before and they can tell which ones. So how did they figure that out again?
They use JavaScript to rewrite the page. It's hidden now anyway, so you don't see anything going on.
Okay, I got that
so
part.
So they write in a bunch of links to a bunch of sites that they know how to imitate, and then they read the color that those links turn.
Oh, no. Are you serious? That really is clever.
So if they see that, you know, let's say they can imitate 50 sites, they'd put up the 50 links, see which ones change color, and then imitate one of those.
Oh, my gosh. That's brilliant. It's brilliant.
It's brilliant, yeah, but not in a good way.
No, not at all.
Diabolical, I think is the term.
Diabolical, there you go. That sounds right. Okay.
So that way they're not just shooting in the dark. They're not just, you know, spraying out, well, if we do 500 people with Gmail, one of them's bound to have Gmail. They actually can tailor it very easily to you.
Wow.
So
okay.
How do you protect yourself?
Right.
If you want to be 100% protected, you can snip the lead or you can simply turn off all JavaScript. Mm-hmm. Both about as impractical.
Right.
So we'll skip over that.
Okay.
A sufficiently skilled user, and I've very carefully chosen those words, can use NoScript to limit their exposure.
You're talking about the plugin for Firefox called NoScript, right?
Yeah. It's a plugin that basically allows you to decide what domains you want to allow JavaScript from. But it means you have to decide, and you have to make those decisions in an informed way. So it's positively no good for a user who's not fairly expert.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why you hate it so much.
Hey, did you just call me
non-expert?
No,
I'm not saying you're not expert.
Yes, you did. Like, that's what you just said.
No, you don't like recommending it because it means people have to know a lot.
Well, as I
it's
recall,
not one of those solutions you can go to a random person who says, I want to protect myself. Oh, okay, here's the answer. Just do this. Because it's not a just do this.
Yeah, as I recall, when I used it for a while, it was constantly asking me, so do you want to let JavaScript be on here? And I was like, I have no way to vet why I would or wouldn't say yes.
My basic technique on that, I just have it in the bottom bar. I don't have it in an intrusive place. Uh-huh. And I just ignore it. And so any JavaScript that blocks, I just completely ignore it until the point that I'm on a web page where it doesn't work. The web page is not functional. Okay. Then I'll go and say, okay, you can do this.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
That's my personal technique, mm-hmm. which means that so many ads just disappear because they're all done in stupid JavaScript and Flash, which is ridiculous. I don't need ads bouncing around the page.
Right. All so I'm using Flash. I'm using Flashblock for that. But hey, once I start doing HTML5 ads, I'm doomed again, aren't I?
Well, no script. If they're based on JavaScript to make the HTML5 do cool stuff, then you're not host if you use no script.
Okay.
Anyway, that we're getting off track here.
Okay.
So that is a solution if you are comfortable doing that. Mm-hmm. Another solution is to simply any site that is either sensitive, like a bank, or like your email, or that's a high priority target, like Facebook or Twitter, because people want to take over your Facebook and Twitter to spam the crap out of all of your friends. Mm-hmm. So they're at their sites people like to attack. Use site-specific browsers for those. So set up an SSB for those five or six sensitive sites that you go to, and only ever use
SSB
them.
Was site-specific
browser.
Okay.
So you can do that using, what was it, the Fluid.app, obviously, and Prism from Firefox. I think there's support for that somewhere in Google Chrome that I haven't figured out yet because I forgot to look. So there's a couple of different ways of doing this. And then if you get into the habit that your bank is never going to be in your normal browser, your bank is going to be in this special bank-only browser, and your Facebook is going to be in this special Facebook-only browser, if those suddenly show up in your main browser, that will set off alarm bells.
Right.
Because it should be over there, now it's over here. Don't enter in your details.
I like that.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Now, I have been doing that. I've been doing a good job of doing that with my bank. I created a... Mm-hmm. I think I'm excuse me, more fond of Prism, but I created a site-specific browser for my bank, and I called it Bank. So when when I want to go to the bank, I hit my command 1 to go to launch bar, I type in bank, character turn, and I'm on my bank. And I'm never, ever, 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 ever at my bank unless I'm in there.
Exactly. So if your bank suddenly shows up in your main browser, that will set off alarm bells.
And at the rate that Facebook is getting, starting to get attacked, it seems like that's probably a brilliant idea to create one of those.
Yeah, and I would avoid using the Flickr website and just stick to your client. This is a simple way to avoid that problem.
Stick to your client.
Yeah, so stick to using Nambu or whatever. Don't use www.twitter.com.
Oh, Twitter. You said Flickr.
Oh, oops.
Yeah, I was going, really? There's a Flickr client? I need one of those. Why don't I have that?
See, there are Flickr clients, actually. I just haven't found one I like.
You said Fricker, by the way.
Fricker. Oh, this is this bloody Web 2.0.
Whatever there is, I'm sure there was no E in it anywhere.
Exactly. Another thing to do, and this is a good habit to be in anyway. Mm-hmm. Every single solitary time, any web page, anywhere, asks you to enter login details, glance at the address bar.
Mm.
Because this fancy tab nabbing, it has changed the favicon, it has changed the web page. What it cannot do is change the URL bar. It cannot say https://facebook.com.
Oh, good point.
And again, if it's anyway sensitive, demand there be an HTTPS to log in on.
Sure.
And then you're good, you're golden again. And the other thing that occurs to me is that because this happens when tabs are in the background, I am sure it is only a matter of time until some smart Firefox plugin is developed to freeze JavaScript in tabs that are in the background.
Oh, that would be smart, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so if the only place JavaScript can run is where you're watching, then it can't morph the page in front of your eyes because you're kind of likely to notice that.
And there's not really any legitimate reason it would run in the background.
No, there may be if you're streaming audio or something. So you may have to have some sort of thing where you can, you know, the way you can allow pop-ups from sites.
Right.
You may have to say, I want this one in the background.
Oh, okay.
But they're going to be very few and very far between.
And that's an opt-in, which is nice.
That's an opt-in, yeah, exactly. Opt-in, not opt-out. So that makes perfect sense.
Then again, how many times have you been sitting there going, what is talking to me? And you're flipping through all your tabs trying to find the open one.
Which annoying website decided I want audio?
Last night it happened to Steve, and we must have gone through 30 tabs before we found the one where Leo had started talking for some reason.
Yeah, and that again proves the point that people tend to have an awful lot of tabs.
Yeah.
So you don't remember what's in all 40 of those tabs.
Right.
So if one of them suddenly morphed into Gmail and you were a regular Gmail user and you were looking for a Gmail tab, you could easily fall for this.
Oh, I have no doubt I would fall for this. So just so people know, you know, I'm always pushing on Bart that he can't give us hard solutions. In the time we were chatting about the site-specific browser creation, I created a site-specific browser. I mean, you pop open Prism, you type in the URL you want to go to, you give it a name. If you you have a couple little options, like do you want to allow navigation? Maybe you don't, so that you don't accidentally get off of that site. And then give it an icon and you're done. I mean, it's boom, you're done. It's like 15 seconds to create one of these.
Unless you're like me and you're very picky, so you spend half an hour making a pretty icon.
Well, I do go back and do that, but it's functional before that. Now, my problem is that it is a lot of times I'll get an email that says, hey, somebody wrote on your wall, and that's what makes me go to Facebook. And I hit that, it's going to open Firefox.
Uh-huh, unless you have Choosy installed.
Oh, you did tell us about Choosy. Maybe I go back and do that.
So what I have done is I've specified a rule in Choosy that if the URL begins with, now in my case, I mean Flickr this time. I have a Flickr SSB to keep my Flickr stuff together. So any URL beginning with http://flickr.com gets diverted by Choosy to that site-specific browser.
Got it.
So you could do a similar one for Facebook. So you click on a link in your email, and suddenly you end up in your SSB instead of on your general browser.
Excellent. Now I have the motivation, Mr. DeMille.
Excellent.
All right, good. Well, that's good to know. So no script if you're crazy, site-specific browser if you're normal, and all of us take a look and make sure it says HTTPS before you put in your password.
And that it's the right domain. So if it's a Gmail login screen and it says newyorktimes.com, then it's wrong. Don't enter your details.
Right. Okie dokie.
I think that wraps it up.
All right, cool. So now that we've eaten our vegetables...
Some fun time.
Yay!
Do you have your camera ready?
I have my camera ready. It's right here.
Good, good. So we promised last time we did sort of an introduction to taking control of your camera, and we looked at the really important stuff, which is sort of the triangle of photography, your ISO, your shutter, and your aperture. And we looked at how at the start you give the camera complete control and then you little by little take back some of that control. And we said that there are other things you can take control of, but we're not going to confuse your poor little head now. We'll leave it a few weeks till we confuse your poor little head. So here we are.
I'm up to the challenge, Bart. I should tell people, excellent. I actually used what Bart taught us a couple of weeks ago when I was at All Things Digital. I was having trouble. I was getting a lot of blurry photos that people were moving too much because I was at using my 200x zoom. And so I went into shutter priority. I set the shutter to 1/30th and I cranked the ISO up to 1600 and I got some great photos. It was a marked difference in my photos from before and after I did that.
I'm assuming they're going to be in the show notes because you're going to talk lots about D.
Yeah, I might have mentioned a little bit about D.
You might have mentioned a little bit. Okay, so we'll get to see your photos in the show notes.
Right.
Excellent. Okay, so the next step, we're just going to look at basically three things. What exactly should the take the picture button do? How exactly do you want the light meter to decide what's right? And how do you want the autofocus to decide what counts as in focus?
Ooh.
So they're very important things.
Yeah.
So the most obvious thing is the shutter button. By default, when you press the button, it takes a photo. This is not particularly shocking. But you may actually want it to do some subtly different things. So another mode that's very handy. So single shot is the normal default mode. So you hit the button halfway down, it autofocuses, and then the whole way down, it takes the picture.
Right.
That's the default. And in fact, you can hammer it the whole way down, and it will do its focus thing and then take the shot the moment it finds a focus lock.
Right.
So there may be a lag between you pressing the button the whole way and the picture actually going click. And that's it focusing, and when it finds focus, there it goes.
I am amazed at how many people don't know about that lightly holding it part. Is you'll see people take a picture of two people standing in front of a mountain or a waterfall behind them, and it's focused on the waterfall behind them, and they don't know to just, on any camera, not just SLRs, if you point it at what you want to focus on, like the belly of the person, hold it partway down, and then just keep holding it, and then frame it, and then push it the rest of the way, you get a perfectly focused photo.
Yeah. And that's actually something I really want to mention, this concept of meter, and then recompose, and then press the rest of the way, because in terms of the next two topics, the light meter and the autofocus, that's a very important technique to get to know. Now, in terms of the button, we're just mentioning it now because it's important for the rest of the
plot.
Discussion.
Plot.
We'll call it plot. So half press means focus, and then it keeps those settings till you press the whole way down. It takes the picture.
Okay.
Now, you may not want to just take a single picture. The most obvious thing other than single shot is to go into the appropriate menu. Now, I don't know what it is in a Canon, because neither of us own a Canon, but if you go into your... if you hit the menu button and go down to the pencil, which stands for settings, custom settings, and then you go to shooting mode, you'll see that you have the default is single frame, which is at the top. Then the next useful one is continuous, which is the rapid fire mode. Yeah.
That's how you get that's how you get 500 track photos in a day. It's using that button. Right.
I suppose we talked last time about using it to get the perfect focus on a butterfly. You know, the first time you press, you have a bit of camera shake. You have a bit of camera shake when you release, but the middle shot is going to be much better. So you fire three, keep the middle, is one way to use it. But if it's some sort of rapid thing that you want to try get, you know, there's a bird flapping by you, and you want to get it where the wings are in just the right spot, track the bird, keep firing, and one of those shots, the wings will be in the position you want. Sometimes it'll be too high, sometimes it'll be too low, but you'll get the Goldilocks moment somewhere in between.
Okay.
So that's your rapid fire. Very useful. The amount of shots you can fire off depends on two things. How big the buffer is in your camera, because it's taking information so quickly, it can't get it onto the SD card. So the other, so how much it has in RAM, effectively, before it has to get it onto the hard disk, which is your SD card, and how fast of an SD card you've bought. So the faster your SD card, the more shots you can do in a rapid fire.
So there might actually be a reason to pay extra for the fancier ones.
Yes, I bought an exceptionally fast card exactly for this reason. Hmm. And it's given me twice as much on rapid fire than I used to get before I bought the fancy card.
Many, many butterflies.
Yes, also, it's also way quicker to get the photos off the camera when you're done, which is also nice.
Oh, that's good to know. Yeah, not lazy, impatient.
Impatient, yes. So that's a good reason to spend the extra money on a fast card. Then the third mode that you may find interesting is the 10-second delay. So the idea being you hit the shutter, then you have 10 seconds and the camera fires. So this is for your group shot. You set the camera up on a tripod, you pose everyone, you imagine yourself in a certain space, you click the button, you run over and you try to look natural, and then 10 seconds later, click.
No, that's not what happens. It doesn't actually click.
That's what happens.
You run halfway back to the camera and that's when it clicks.
Yeah, because 10 seconds is actually a lot longer than you think.
Right.
So you think it hasn't gone off, you've just given up, and then click.
Right.
Or everyone's file is completely faded because their muscles are all hurting. But anyway, that's the theory.
All right.
Then the other thing you will find in that menu, depending again on your manufacturer, if your camera supports an infrared remote rather than one that physically plugs in somewhere, you will tell the camera to go looking for that remote in that same menu. So on our Nikon D40, we have single, continuous, self-timer. Then we have two more modes at the bottom, delayed remote and quick response remote. So delayed remote is the same 10-second timeout thing, but instead of having to run from the camera, you can walk at your leisure, stand among your friends, then click with the remote, and all you have to do in those couple of seconds is hide the remote, which is much easier.
Okay.
And then the last one is instant remote, which means the moment you click the remote, it's as if you just clicked the button in the normal mode.
Okay.
So that's, I use that a lot for my astronomy shots, because if you touch the camera for a 2-second exposure, you're going to get camera shake. You set it up, you point it the way you want, you step back and you touch nothing, and then you use the remote to set it off.
Okay.
So that's all you can do with the button. Still useful to know, though.
Sounds good.
So the next one is the light meter. So at all these points, we've been saying that if you choose, say, shutter priority, you're going to assume responsibility for what the shutter speed is going to be, and the camera's light meter is going to give the camera the information to pick the matching aperture and or ISO, depending on whether you've left the ISO in auto, or like you did in your case, you took control and rammed the ISO right up.
Okay.
But that final leg of the triangle is being left up to the camera, and it has to know what's right based on measuring the light, i.e. it uses its light meter. But the light meter can operate in a couple of different modes. The default is what it calls a matrix mode. It may not be the default in 100% of all cameras, but every camera I've ever picked up, the default is matrix mode. It takes the entire scene and averages it out to neutral grey. Now, there's some debate on the internet as to whether this is 18 or 14%. We are going to say 18, but we could be wrong, okay? So no need to send me 20 squillion emails pointing this out.
Okay.
Right, so neutral grey, which is fine for most normal situations, but it's not always fine. So if you're, say, in a place with a fairly high dynamic range, it's going to average it all out. So the stuff that's very bright is exposed for too long, so it's all washed out. And the stuff that's very dark isn't exposed long enough, so it's all sort of drowned out. So on average, the entire picture is in fact rubbish. Nothing is properly exposed.
Okay.
So we leave. That's the default, and it works a lot of the time, but it's not perfect. Now, you can tweak the default by using exposure compensation to tell it, yeah, I know that's what you think is okay, but just go one stop bigger, will you? And that's where your exposure compensation kicks in.
Well, so I'm going to back you up on the metering. This is something that drives me crazy in the Nikon, is I can control that, and I know which button you're looking at, but it doesn't use any words. It uses pictures. So it has a picture of a little girl, and then the middle picture is of a flower, and the third picture appears to be a lamp with some ducks on a table or something. And it's got three symbols next to him. The way I get to this is I hit the info button that's right next to the shutter, to the trigger. I hit that, and then the matching green button down in the bottom left is what shows you the control for those things. And then you hit the OK button. This may be a little too inside Nikon at this point.
Okay, this is also not how I do it.
Okay, I have no idea how you're getting to it.
I go to menu.
Okay.
And then I go to the same little pencil menu, and then I go to metering.
Pencil menu, okay. I've never gone in this way. Okay, to metering.
The pencil menu is great. All your cool stuff's in here. Everything we talk about today is in the pencil
menu. Okay, so they don't have the picture of the little girl, and they do have the word matrix center weighted and spot. That's more useful than the picture of the little girl and the flower and the lamp with the ducks. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what the ducks have to do with anything. Okay. Yeah, so that's always how I've done it.
Okay.
So the icon for matrix is, it looks like, I always think it looks like a SIM card.
Yeah.
But what it basically means is it shows all the areas the camera can sense and they're all filled in. So in other words, I'm using it all.
Oh, I got you. Got it.
Okay.
So the second
one. That's the one extreme. Use it all. Average it all out. The second extreme is called spot metering, which means we take the point at the very center of the image and we measure only that point. And we take that point and we make that point neutral gray, which is useless 99.9% of the time. The only time it's useful is if you have a gray card. So these are little pieces of cardboard or plastic that are made to be neutral gray. And so you hold it up in the light that you're standing in, you point the camera's spot on that, you half press, and then you point at whatever you want and you fully press.
Okay.
Then it will be quote-unquote the perfect exposure.
But everything else in the picture is going to be rubbish on a real photo.
If you do that in real life, the chances are what's in the middle is a tree, which is not 18% gray, or a flower, which is not 18% gray, or there's almost nothing in the real world is 18% gray.
Okay.
Now, if you want to do the zone system that was invented by Ansel Adams, and then you can look at a rock and instinctively know how much exposure compensation you need to make that rock look the right color, then fair enough, but the head wrecking stuff.
Okay.
So I've never used spot metering, ever.
Okay.
But there is a happy medium between those two horrible extremes, which is center-weighted metering. Which means the middle has more importance, but it's not
absolute
a single
truth
spot for measuring. Yeah. Okay. So this is represented in the diagram as sort of a big circle in the middle, not a point in the middle, but a circle in the middle. So you have a region in the middle and you make that region in the middle look right.
So it's just saying grandma's pretty darn important, but you know what? We like the rest of the family too.
Yeah, exactly. So this is perfect for somewhere like a rock concert, say, where the people on stage are in spotlights and the edge of the stage is in darkness. If you were to use matrix metering, it would take into account those dark edges and ruin the whole exposure. Hmm. Whereas with center weighted, the center is what's given priority. So the band is focused on and the band is exposed correctly. And to hell with what happens around the edges.
Hmm. Okay.
Which is perfect.
Yeah.
Now this is again where your half press and recompose comes in, because let's say that you're out in a scene where you have, it's sunset, the sky is dramatically different in brightness to the ground, and you want to have the things on the ground look right and you're happy to blow the sky out. Center weighted, point down, half click, recompose, and away you go.
Okay. That sounds pretty good. I should have been using that all along. Now, those kind of controls are only available when you get off of the full auto mode.
Yes, these things will be grayed out if you're in too automatic a mode, because the camera will do it all for you.
Okay.
It knows best. Now, I have to say, I leave my camera in matrix, and I'm just very comfortable with exposure compensation.
Okay. You just said matrix was really bad, everything looks like rubbish, and then you said you leave it in matrix.
I leave it in matrix, but I know that I'm going to use exposure compensation to push it one way or the other.
And when you say exposure compensation, you're saying you're using the plus a little bit, minus a little bit, open stops.
So you're literally biasing the meter. You're saying, no, I don't care about neutral gray. I want the gray to be a little more this way or a little more that way. Okay. And so you're just biasing it and you're saying, yeah, you think it should be this bright. I'm saying make it one stop brighter.
Okay.
Or one stop darker. And because I tend to photograph things that, you know, hang around for a bit, that works perfectly. And also things like butterflies, you don't have massive variance between the brightest and the darkest, so the matrix is perfect. It's just landscape shots you need to be careful of. If you have a dark sky, sorry, a dark ground and a bright sky, you choose either I want the sky or I want the ground. And right. So you choose just by biasing it. So that's I don't want to spend too long because, like you say, we're...
Right, right. I'm still confused a little bit, though. I don't understand why we're even talking about gray. Unless I'm taking a picture of a rock with no lichen on it, I'm never taking a picture of gray intentionally.
Yes, but it's to get the brightness right. If the photo is too bright... So basically, the way you should think of this is we suck the color out of the image and we're left with a black and white image. The average of that black and white image should be neutral gray. And then it will look right to our eyes.
What? But none of it's gray.
No, but it's the amount of light. We don't care what color each part of light is. We just care how much light there is.
Okay.
So we're only looking at the brightness of the light, not the color of the light.
Okay. Okay. I thought we were talking
about... That makes
sense.
So yeah. It's color agnostic. It doesn't care whether it's lots of red light. It's just, it's lots of light.
Okay.
So we want to get the amount of light right, because otherwise when we look at the photograph, it'll look too bright or too dark.
Okay.
And to the human eye, neutral gray looks right.
All right, got it. So, you know, we were going to go on to the autofocus part of this, but I really want to make sure I have time to ask lots of questions here. And so I'm actually going to cut you off and not let you finish that part and have it be the teaser for the next time.
Excellent. So I have less show notes to write next week.
That's right. That's right. That'll be good. Well, I think I've got a little bit more of the hang of this, and I'm gonna experiment with that. I got to tell you, to be honest, I have yet to successfully do anything with the aperture priority like I wanted to. And I think one of the problems is every time I've tried to do it, I didn't have enough light to open the aperture up like I wanted to.
Right.
So the photos were real dark and looked stupid, and like I was taking them indoors without a flash and with a slow lens. So I think maybe that's the problem.
Well, you can only do the best with the light you have. If there ain't no light there, it doesn't really matter what setting you use. There ain't no light there.
Yeah. And then I grabbed my iPhone and I took a picture with that and it looked really good. Every once in a while, the iPhone does better. The iPhone's really good at skies. Take pictures of clouds.
You have the 3GS, though, don't you?
Yeah?
Yeah, because the 3G's camera is real barf. It's horrific.
I thought they were the same camera. Did they actually upgrade
a little
bit?
No, you guys have that touch-to-focus thing.
Ah, yeah, that is
our camera doesn't even focus.
Okay. But that fourth gen is coming out there, Bart. You got your eye on that?
Oh, yeah.
What if he pouts and doesn't come out with it because Gizmodo ruined it and he's making a different one now?
Then I'll be angry. I'll go beyond grumpy to angry.
I guess so. All right. Well, hey, I got a little bit further in understanding, and I actually found a different way to get to the menus. When we get off the air, I'll have to walk you through how I was doing it.
Sure. I'll be curious. Always nice to learn something new.
All right. We looking good for next weekend, or are you finally going to visit Mom?
I believe next weekend I'm meeting the MacCrack guys, so I'll be here. We'll be able to record either Saturday or Sunday.
Okay, sounds great. So we'll finish this tease we had on autofocus.
Indeed we will. And if anyone has any questions about what we've talked about today, if they email them into Allison, then we can include them in next week's discussion.
Ooh, sounds good.
Okay, until next time, happy computing.
Well, I hope people are still here for the end of the show. That was certainly a long one, wasn't it? You can't believe how many stories I left out of the show, but I had to cut it off somewhere. I hope you'll join us in the live chat room one of these days. It's so much fun to chat with the Nosilla castaways, and they keep me on my toes. Dale was one of our newest people. I don't know if I missed anybody else, but it was fun to see Dale in there this time. Check it out at podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. In the meantime, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.